family. My name is Santee and I'm an addict. I know it's usually generally ladies before gentlemen. I want to thank Francis for letting me go first. Francis was going to go first, but you know, like sometimes it's hard to stop the old ways, you know, because I used to like to go first one to take a hit, you know. Yeah, I mean, I'm first, you know. First one to use the works. Yeah, I gotta use them works first, you know. In my little crew, I was the first one to start doing things, and so those habits, you know, sort of stick with you. I mean, and things in your youth, sometimes you carry them over. And I'm here speaking because my sponsor suggested that I speak. I've worked with youth, but when I was a youth, there was no Narcotics Anonymous. You know, when I started shooting dope and getting high, there was no Narcotics Anonymous. Growing up in D.C., you had St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which had a detox unit in it, but that was about it. Other than that, you go to jail and you kick cold turkey, you know. But as a youth, there was no N.A., you know, and I want to thank God today that there is an N.A. I want to thank God for each and every one of you. And after I got into recovery, I did work with youth. You know, I worked with youth for quite a while. It's a very, very difficult job. You know, it is a very difficult job. I work with youth, I work with women, all women, and I work with all men. The youth are the most difficult. Women are next, a close second, you know, working with all women. The thing about it is, we hear throughout this literature that we are more alike than we are different. And working with all three of these particular entities in these three particular communities, I found that there are certain things that common to myself exist in all of us because we are more alike than we are different, and it does not matter. The issues change a little bit, you know. But the thing of it is, this disease that caught me, you know, starting at the age of, I don't know, I guess I maybe been 9 or 10 years old, first time I drank a beer, you know, my stepfather would actually tell me to go to the refrigerator and get him a beer. And I'd always take a sip, you know, not really knowing, you know, the ultimate consequences that would come from it. I would take a sip, or my mother would tell me to light a cigarette, not really knowing, you know, light the cigarette on the stove, you know, not really knowing that eventually these habits would become my habits. And in youth, it's a very difficult time because you have not fully developed. You know, your personality is not developed. And my personality surely had not been developed. And unbeknownst to me at the time, I had issues with a lot of things in life that I wasn't even aware of. You know, issues like I had abandonment issues because my mother had left me with my grandmother, you know, when I was very, very young. I grew up calling my grandmother Mama, and I called my mother by her name, just like my aunts, you know, because I grew up in a very matriarchal, female-dominated, you know, family, and I did not have any male role models at all. You know, I had a grandfather, but he was a drunk. You know, I mean, it was just simple as that. He was a drunk, you know. And so I grew up in this very matriarchal setting with no male role models, and so I had to reach outside of the family setting to get a male role model. And one of my first male role models was a guy who used to hang around a pool room on 8th and 8th Street Northeast in D.C., and he used to sell marijuana, and I used to like this guy, you know. I used to like this guy. I can remember like it was yesterday. He had a trench coat and a pair of Nelton loafers and a pair of gabardine slacks, and he used to sell weed. And me, here again, always being the first in my little crew to do certain things, I ventured down and became friends with him, and eventually, you know, I was the guy on my block or with my little crew that knew how to cop everywhere, you know, and this insanity, you know, kept going all through high school and everything else. And because there was no NA and there was nobody to tell me, you know, and nobody could tell me anything, you know, I was the man. You know, I was the oldest child. You know, I had no male role models, you know. My mama couldn't tell me what to do. It was very important to me. And all the time, I was just this really this little insecure child because I stopped growing it. I stopped it maturing emotionally when I was 9 years old. You know, like, over the years, after being in recovery, I found, you know, like, that's one of the things that I did as a youth, and that's one of the things that youth do. You know, they stop growing. The minute they start getting high, they stunt their growth emotionally. People, you know, say, you know, smoke a cigarette. I remember one of the myths was if you smoke cigarettes, you'd be short. You know, you do be short. You know, you get short when you start using at an early age like that. And you do not, and I did not mature emotionally. As a matter of fact, I didn't come into this fellowship until I was, you know, in my late 40s, you know. And I spent, you know, over 30 years in jails, you know, in active addiction, engaged in insanity. And it is only because I killed a guy, a young guy, you know, a young guy who represented everything that I had ever been, you know. And when I killed this guy, it was like, I knew I was killing him, you know. It started off self-defense, but that final blow, I knew I was killing him, you know. It was like and at the same time, it was like I was exercising something out of my own system. And this was one of them young guys that in active addiction, when you out on the corner, would be the guy on the corner, get the hell on home, old man. You ain't got no business out here smoking crack. But he was talking to me. And it was like out of, you know, and it was like a lot of the young guys that I saw, it was like they thought that they the first ones that ever did this thing. You know, I got that impression. They thought that they were the first ones that ever did this. And this was stuff that I had did when I was their age, you know. And after this guy's death, you know, what started off as an act of self-defense, ultimately, you know, D.C. don't have self-defense laws, so you go to jail, you know. So, but you know, eventually the charge was thrown out. And I didn't come to this fellowship willingly. I came to this fellowship because a judge named Richter told me, if you come in this courtroom high one more time with a dirty urine, I'm going to lock you up. And that was April the 28th, you know. And that was the last day I got high, you know. So, you know, sometimes we have to be scared and we have to be kicked and pushed into this thing. You know, God in his infinite wisdom will push you into this thing, you know, will give you a little nudge here and there. And in my story, that is my case. You know, I did not come to Narcotics Anonymous willingly. And when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I came to Narcotics Anonymous thinking that it was to stop using drugs. And that once I stopped using drugs, everything else would fall into place. And for those of us who know what recovery is about, you know that that's not it, you know. Stop using drugs is just opening the doorway to allow you to begin to engage. For me, it allowed me to begin to understand what recovery was about. My problems did not change. And through working the steps, I finally discovered that when I was young, I wanted to be a dope fiend. You know, nobody made me be a dope. I wanted to be a dope fiend. You know, I wanted to walk around with the coat over my arm to hide my tracks. You know, I wanted all of the things. I wanted to be accepted, you know. I wanted to have, that was my personality, you know, because I didn't have anything. Nobody taught me how to be a man, you know, and nobody told me anything about spiritual principles. And so I wanted to be like those things that appeared to be fashionable. I wanted to have that kind of personality. And I see it every day today, you know, like I see it in our culture, you know, in terms of the music, you know, like the young people generally listen to, and the bling bling and all of that. I see all of that. And a lot of time, I identify with it. I can understand why so many of young people are seduced, you know, like along those lines. Because I was seduced in a different way. But there were elders who told me things at that time that I took no heed to and paid no attention to, simply because I thought, you know, oh man, they don't know, you know, I know. And I get the same thing from young people that I've worked with now, and I see myself in them, you know, and I have to just pray and try to give them information that hopefully won't allow them to go down the path that, you know, I've gone down, you know, and make the mistakes, you know, that I have made. And that's something about, you know, like Narcotics Anonymous, this fellowship, you know, this fellowship. And I say fellowship because a fellowship is basically two or more people who support each other. You know, and this is one of the, you know, this gang here is bigger than any gang that I ever belonged to. You know, I get more strength and more love, you know, and more security from this gang than any gang that I ever been involved with. You know, and a lot of times it's sort of overwhelming. I remember the first time that I came to a convention, I remember it was this guy, the keynote speaker was a guy named Kareem, and he was saying how he didn't get into recovery until later years in his life, you know. And he talked about how his sponsor was 25 years old and he was 60. And after he had a couple of years clean time, it occurred to him, I've been waiting all this time for this blessing. All this time I done messed up all 40 years of my life, you know, shooting dope and being a dope fiend, and I had to wait this long to get to where I'm at, you know. And his sponsor told him, say, if you got a check and it was 40 years late, would you send it back, you know. And, you know, that meant something to me. I mean, I felt that and I remembered that, you know, and like, so I didn't feel bad after I had wasted, you know, a lot of my youth in terms of, you know, I didn't allow that to be a thing that held me down in terms of feeling bad that it took me all that long to understand the joys of actually being in recovery and actually appreciating life and accepting life on life's turn. Because as I said earlier, you know, I wanted to be a dope fiend. You know, I wanted to be a dope fiend because a dope fiend does not have to make decisions. You know, dope fiend don't have to make decisions. Dope fiend, all the dope fiend decisions is made for him. And it's only one of them. Get it. You know, get high. You know, that decision is all, it don't matter how you do it. You know, I didn't like to make decisions. You know, all my decisions would have been made for me. I didn't like to work. I didn't have to make a decision about working. You know, whether or not I wanted to. I didn't, you know, a career. I didn't have to make a decision about what career I was going to go into. I was a dope fiend. My career was already defined, you know. And my journey, you know, everything was already laid out for me, you know. And that was the easier, softer way, I thought at the time. That was the easier, softer way. And it was only after getting in recovery I really found out that there is no easier, softer way. You know, there is no easier, softer way. I listen, and it's important that I do listen, because see, I don't learn anything when I talk. You know, it's a scientific fact that people do not learn anything when they talk. You can only learn when you listen. You know, and finally, for the first time in my life, because I've been talking to myself, you know, all my life. You know, I've been talking, you know, and wasn't learning nothing. So finally, I got to a place where I could sit and listen. I could really start to learn something. And I find that this is what happened to me in my youth. I did not listen. You know, I did not listen at all. And it did not occur to me that you do not learn anything when you are talking. You may share what you have learned, but somewhere along the line, you got to shut up and listen and pay attention, and you got to do something, you know. And it was only after, you know, I got to be about 46 years old that I have sense enough to learn anything. You know, I just had to shut up and sit down. The sponsor, you know, sit down in the front row and don't open up your mouth. You know, just listen. And I know it's young people in here, and a lot of you, the title of this particular workshop, it deals with youth. And so I would say this to you, and I would encourage you just to remember that. You don't learn anything when you talk, you know. We really need to learn how to listen. And to listen doesn't necessarily mean that you sit there and you record everything I say, or you hear everything I say. To listen means to internalize. You internalize. We hear with our ears. We internalize with our hearts and our minds. That's where we listen at. You know, and a lot of time, it's like I had to listen to my sponsor. My sponsor is younger than I am. You know, but I love my sponsor. Sponsorship is wonderful. You know, sponsorship is really wonderful, because sponsorship gave me the father that I didn't have. Sponsorship gave me the big brother that I didn't have. You know, sponsorship gave me a role model that I didn't have in terms of a male in my life. You know, I knew all about women. Women, I can, yeah, all about women, because they raised me up. And no meaning, you know, that I didn't appreciate any of that information. But I didn't know how to be a man. And when you're 46 years old and you don't know how to be a man, and you got kids, you know, see, my daughter, who to this day, I have not sufficiently worked an eighth step with my daughter. You know, I have not sufficiently mended all of those fences. I remember when I first got in recovery and I had about 6 months clean time, and I hit the number, and so I figured I'm gonna make it up to my daughter. I'm gonna go by there and I'm gonna paint the house and put some carpet on the floor and everything. And she let me do all that stuff. She let me do all that. You know, give her some money, take her to the grocery store. She let me do all that. And then at the end of the work was done, she said, "This does not make up for all them years you was in the penitentiary." She's, you know, and that really, you know, it hurt because I thought I was doing something, you know, I thought I was working an eighth step, you know, in terms of some things and some damage and wreckage of my past. And she told me that, you know, this is not make up for all that time, you know. And when I think about all the time that I wasted in my youth, you know, because I did a lot of time in the penitentiary. So in my youth, I received a lot of, I'm a child of the 60s, and I received a lot of information during the 60s that really made me, that justified and fed my addiction, you know, because I thought that, and one of the things I always thought about in the 60s was like, my great-great-grandfather never got his 40 acres and his mule, I'm going to take mine, you know. And then, when I eventually did hook up with my father, he had a picture of my great-great-grandfather, who was, you know, part of my genealogy during the time of slavery. And the picture of this man looked like Colonel Sanders. You know. And I could not, you know, here I am. I had justified robbing banks, you know, because my ancestors were slaves, you know, and I was mistreated, and they never got their 40s and they knew. And when I robbed the bank, I ain't do nothing but buy some dope with it, you know. I ain't do nothing with the money but buy some dope with it and enslave myself some more, you know. And I saw this man, he looked like Colonel Sanders, you know. He even had on a white suit. What happened was my great-great-grandfather was a man who used to brand the slaves. And he fell in love with a slave, and somehow does I come through that line, you know. But the misinformation that I got as a youth, you know, like during the 60s, you know, like kept me going on and on. The only place that I have not gotten any misinformation from is this fellowship. You know, I have not gotten any misinformation at all. And one of the first things that you told me when I came here was, do not pick up. You know. And another good piece of information somebody gave me was that you only have to do it one time. One time. You only have to do it one time. And that sounds so simple. You ain't got to do it but one time. You know. And I was in a group this morning, and I heard a person say, you know, like, recovery, you know, is not a destination. Recovery is a journey. And I've been on this journey, be 9 years come April 28th. And it's been the best 9 years of my life. And when I was 46 years old, I felt like I was in my teens again. For the first time in my life, I felt like a young man. I felt like I was experienced. The first time I felt like it was the first time I ever had sex. It was the first time I really had a job. It was the first time that I ever really went to school. All that stuff that I did then, it was under the influence. Some sense or another, it was under the influence. It was about being engaged in insanity to some degree. You know, and I'm a certified addictions counselor now. You know, as I said, and I work with, you know, programs, and I put that energy, that same energy that I used to put into other things associated with using, I try to put that energy into what I do in terms of service work. And it's like I do service work that I get paid for, you know. I get paid for service work. That's how I feel about my job sometimes, you know. And I just want to thank y'all for letting me share. And once again, I want to thank Francis for letting me go first. Thank you.